The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
It is a great pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Memphis, Tennessee. Josh Shores is a co-portfolio manager for Longleaf Partners International Fund and a member of Southeastern Asset Management's Executive Committee and Board of Directors. After 7 years in Southeastern's London office, Josh is now based in Memphis and focuses on non-US investments. He joined Southeastern in 2007. A University of North Carolina graduate, Josh holds bachelor's degrees in philosophy and religious studies. We truly appreciate the wisdom and insights Josh has shared with us in the past, and are grateful to have him with us again in this live online forum. So on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, Josh.
Oh, thank you, John. Much appreciated. Glad to be here.
So, Josh, we're going to do this more as a Q&A, and I'd like to invite our participants to feel free to write in questions at any time. I'll just start it off with a very broad question, perhaps going a little bit to your role at Southeastern. You and I had the opportunity to do an interview in London several years ago. You are now in the U.S. Tell us just a little bit about your own path and the firm and your focus these days, please.
Oh, of course. I started, as you said, in 2007 with Southeastern, and my value convictions are similar to probably a lot of folks that are on the line or in the community more broadly, in that I, as a teenager, was interested in investing and started reading up, and took me to various sources, Peter Lynch and then, you know, Hagstrom, and reading about Buffett, and it was literally one of those Damascus Road type of moments where it just clicked that this is exactly what I want to do, and this is the only, you know, sensible way to invest as far as I'm concerned, buying dollars for 50 cents. And I kind of had to strike my own path, because I came to that realization a little bit later. I'd already gotten into studies in philosophy and kind of more liberal arts oriented, and so I had some catching up to do on the technical side of things, if you will. But through that journey of really growing as an investor, I always knew that there were a handful of great value investors that if I ever had the opportunity to work with, I just couldn't pass that up. And Mason Hawkins was one of those on that short list, along with, at the time, of course, Warren Buffett was on there, Seth Klarman was on there. But I never actually thought that opportunity would come. And when it did in early 2007, through a serendipitous occurrence, I did not pass it up and took the opportunity to join Southeastern. Was always focused on non-US investments. So even when I was first with the firm and in the US office, I was here to kind of drink the Kool-Aid and be close to Mason and Staley and the rest of the team that's in the US office, but always focused outside the US, knew that would lead me to be in one of the overseas offices. At some point, we have offices in London and Singapore and a satellite office in Tokyo and in Sydney. I ended up in the London office about 8 years ago, a little over that, and it was an excellent experience. But with joining the executive committee of the firm and the board and taking on some new roles, it was good to be back in the U.S., close to the other people, senior people on that in that world. And our non-U.S. teams have deepened and grown and broadened such that I wasn't really leaving a hole at all by moving out of the London office. So that points to, you know, an interesting thing about Southeastern is that many people see the firm as U.S. focused, often look at kind of the U.S. large cap history, because when Mason founded the firm in 1975, that was, you know, very much the focus originally. But over the course of the 80s and the 90s, we were increasingly investing outside of the United States. And Mason's philosophy, Southeastern's philosophy, has always been, treating our investors as if they're partners of ours. Thinking like an owner and operator in the way we run Southeastern and the way that we partner with people who are invested with us. And so we're always thinking, well, what do we want to do with our own money? Because our own money has to be invested alongside clients. There's no personal accounts or, I own something over here that's not in the client portfolios. It's all the exact same. And so after the Asian crisis in 98, there was so much to be done outside of the U.S. that we felt that we could populate a whole portfolio. And that's when we formally launched our non-U.S. funds. Actually, 20 years ago this month, interestingly enough, is when the non-U.S. strategies at Southeastern were formalized. And we know that we want to be close to boots on the ground, pick up the local flavor of the markets where we invest. And so that's when we opened the Tokyo office. We opened the London office 3 years later in 2001. And initially it was sending, Americans abroad, i.e. people like myself, go overseas and kind of figure it out. But of course, that's not as ideal as building out a local network of value investors who are from those areas and have a deep cultural local understanding, while also being people of integrity who really get value the way that we require. And that just takes a long time to build, a couple decades, actually. But I'd say, that's where we are over the last couple of years in our non-U.S. offices, deepest, broadest team that we've ever had outside the U.S. And that's what provided me the flexibility to be back in the U.S. So long-winded answer to how I have gone from where we last met up in London to being in Memphis.
Terrific. And I know you are probably on planes quite a lot these days. let's focus a little bit on Europe, since this is the focus of this conference. As you reflect on the time you have looked at Europe, just comment on how you think it's changed in terms of the investment landscape and opportunities structurally. Over the last several years, we've been through some headline risks in Europe, and those are still not completely behind us, and there's new things on the horizon. How do you see sort of Europe, if you will, versus North America or Asia as just a place to invest?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question, because we really are looking across the entire world for the best things to do. Now, I think a lot of that is in Europe now, which is appropriate for the conversation at hand. And we really approach the world through the business people price framework, right? Good businesses, competitively advantaged, sustainable moats, people who think and act like owners, ultimately operate the business the right way, think about capital allocation in a value per share building manner, and also price, sufficient margin of safety relative to business quality and the returns that we're trying to underwrite. And so, Europe is no different. We're very bottoms up in how we evaluate all these companies. When it comes to any sort of top-down forecast or prediction on what's going to happen with the Eurozone, for example, or, the Italian debt standoff, I have very little to add as far as worthwhile opinion. Perhaps some do, but we certainly don't. And our philosophy is more, we want to take advantage of the volatility that inevitably comes with those sorts of uncertainties and invest in companies where it doesn't really matter very much because of either a misunderstanding about the company's quality or its exposures, or there's just sufficient margin of safety, period, that those macro factors aren't going to impair your case or result in a permanent loss of capital. And so in that regard, Europe's actually been a pretty fruitful place over the last decade. And the common denominator that we've seen, and this was no big, top-down strategic plan, it was more looking backwards several years ago at where Southeastern had been successful in Europe, is there's an interesting opportunity in our view around European markets, opening up. And when I say opening up, I mean, if you look at maybe the U.S. on one end of the spectrum and parts of Asia on the other end, and that spectrum being defined as shareholder friendliness, where shareholders fit in the stakeholder stack. You know, the U.S. in the 70s was a very different world than it was after the Big Bang and the barbarians at the gate days in the 80s that kind of blew open that cozy agent captured corporate culture. And so you saw through the 80s and the 90s this massive release of value in the U.S., which, you know, today is probably run its course. I don't think there's nearly as much low-hanging fruit that's inefficient capital structures or poorly managed businesses because it gets attacked by activist investors or activist management teams from the inside, and there's just kind of a less room for inefficiency to hide. Asia, on the entire other end of the spectrum, very broadly, and forgive me for any Asian specialist, that's, you know, it's wrong to talk about that part of the world that broadly, but just since this is Europe focused, I'm going to keep it simple, is much less open from a stakeholder friendliness, shareholder as a stakeholder point of view. And not to say that you can't have successful engagement or successful, you know, in Japan, there's a lot of enthusiasm right now in the small and mid-cap space for people getting involved and engaged or active or helping bring about change. And that certainly can happen. What we've found over the years is the return on effort, the return on personal and time, capital that it takes to try to bring about those changes is not optimal for us, at least. And so in Asia, what we've mostly seen is there's still very much a place for conglomerates, whereas the U.S., you know, conglomerates for the most part, unless they truly have some sort of competitive advantage to their conglomerate structure, like a Berkshire Hathaway or maybe a Danaher, they're pretty passe at this point because you don't need a conglomerate to provide capital allocation or corporate governance discipline. The market is developed and evolved such that those strictures are in place. You know, Asia would be on the other end of the spectrum because it's not as developed, not as mature, not as deep on the capital market side for either debt capital or equity capital. And so the conglomerate structure still serves a necessary purpose on efficiency of capital allocation and governance and, you know, overall kind of trust. But, you know, conglomerate type of structures, platform type structures are magnifiers of the characteristics of the people at the top. So if they're good, it can be a leverage point to juice the good factors. If they're bad, then it can magnify those to the downside. So it's very, very important who you're partnering with and, you know, how they're going to allocate capital and how they're going to treat the business. So in Asia, we focus inordinately on partners and particularly change agents like generational change or, you know, other triggers that are starting to unlock value. So all that to say, there's your two ends of the spectrum. Europe, to me, is kind of in the middle. It's moving away from that more, closed structure where it's questionable if shareholders, where they are on the stakeholder stack, to, you know, taking steps towards the other side of the spectrum, which is an interesting opportunity because there still are, you know, big inefficiencies and big kind of conglomerate structures that served a purpose once upon a time and maybe don't anymore that are in the process of being, you know, rationalized. And that often can result in, you know, significant value being created and being released. And so as we looked back over the last decade at what had been successful for us in Europe, it was companies like Philips or companies like Accor or, you know, one that we still own and perhaps we could talk about a little bit later, Exor, where there was this unlocking and releasing of previously either unrealized or hidden or untapped potential and value. And I think that still has a long way to go in Europe. So we see lots of opportunity around that de-conglomeratization, if you will, opportunity around, you know, constructive engagement with companies and management teams, not at all And we don't do this kind of U.S. style activism, if you will, but more owner oriented. Hey, we own 5 or 8 or 10% of the company. We think and act like owners. We want to engage with you like we're all owners of the company. Let's have a dialogue about the strategy, about the capital allocation, about the future of the firm and how to think about those things. And I just say that the receptiveness to that conversation is greatly increased now versus, say, 20 years ago in Europe. So, you know, those two kind of broad themes we found a lot of opportunity in. And then more specifically over the last 12 months, you know, the geographic commonalities of the UK is starting to get very interesting, obviously because of the Brexit dynamic and some of the other things that are happening there. And Italy is starting to get very interesting, just more broadly as far as the opportunity set goes. So that's a quick and dirty, very high level view.
Well, let's maybe touch on Exor a little bit since you brought it up, and it's certainly a company where it seems like a very engaged owner-operator is at the helm and has the right outlook on capital allocation. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of your involvement there. How do you view owning Exor versus Fiat and just your general take on that as a long-term opportunity to partner with a great owner-operator?
We first got involved with Exor in 2012, and it was via the classic sitting around and reading. So I was going through shareholder letters and annual reports and was reading this letter written by John Elkann that literally could have been, you know, go back at 2010, 11, 12, read those annual letters. It felt like I was talking to a dyed-in-the-wool value, long-term value creator, realizer. Philosophically, he understood everything. And so reading these letters was this kind of eye-opening, oh my gosh, you know, what's happening here? And at that point, now Exor is a little bit more of a known commodity, but at that point, it was still very early days. It was only a few years since John had overseen the combination of the Legacy II and Yelly family firms. Fiat still was one piece instead of all the things that have been spun out since then. And there still were three share classes. There were ordinary shares and the Sabre shares, and the third share class, both of which were legacies of kind of the 80s and 90s when Italy was trying to broaden equity ownership amongst the population. And so there were some extra incentives, but no votes. And so the initial interest was in John as a capital allocator. And, you know, it's one thing to read what somebody says. It's another thing to read what they say and then go back and go through their track record, go through the network to find people who know them and have known them for a long time and see that what they say matches what they've done. You know, talk is cheap in a lot of circumstances, but once you see and personal indicators match the publicly espoused philosophy, that's a much stronger signal of future behavior. And so we went through that process and then were able to go meet with John and his team and start to understand a little better directly from them how they thought and what their plans were. And at that point, I can't say that I was able to foresee the stupendous unlocking of value that Ferrari would turn out to be, or the cleverness at which they would buy Partner Re, or Case New Holland spin out, you know, any of those things. But we knew that John got it from a long-term value creation perspective. He was young, so there was a multi-decade track record ahead of him. And there were lots of levers to pull and lots of interesting businesses, because the quality question would have been like, okay, well, how much of Fiat at that point was, quote, quality? Well, we knew Ferrari was. We knew Case and New Holland were, which were still inside and came out via Fiat Industrial. And we knew that there was lots of potential to unlock that value. So we initially went in via some of the discounted shares, because we also knew that those share classes tend to collapse into one eventually, and that generally that happened at par. So the discounted Saver shares, which were generally 10 or 15% below the ordinary shares, would be exchanged one for one. And we didn't know that was going to happen, but we suspected it would. So we got as much as we could via that class, and then via ordinary shares, and built up to kind of a mid-single digits percentage of XOR over the course of 2012. And then I'd say the most intelligent thing that we've done since then is as little as possible, because there's very little that needs to happen as far as suggesting, have you thought about this or what about this? Because the team at XOR is always thinking about those things. And there's been, you know, so much value creation via very intelligent moves that we've just watched the value grow and grow and compound, such that even though the share price has compounded in the, well, we're off a little bit over the last few weeks, so I'm not sure what it is mark to market just to today, but it was kind of low 20% over the last 6 years recently. I think the value has compounded even faster. And so we still happily own those shares. To your question on having that versus, you know, FCA directly or Ferrari itself, that's a great question. And you can certainly make the case that we'd have been much more intelligent to have some of the spins in, instead of just owning it upstairs. I think over the full kind of multi-decade cycle potential of XOR, you will be better off owning upstairs. I mean, our general philosophy is you want to be as high up the capital stack and as aligned with the people making the decisions as you can be, which in this case would be, you know, the XOR level is as high as you can get. And, you know, John made the same case at the Capital Markets Day late last year that, you know, ultimately being at the Topco level would provide more compounding potential because you get the, you know, capital allocation prowess of being able to shift back and forth between the different investment opportunities. And, you know, really what we think the potential is over the next decade or two to be unlocked is integrating PartnerRe and the float generated by PartnerRe more across the rest of XOR. And, you know, you have to have a very long-term time horizon to see this. It's not going to happen in the next year or two. But, you know, we've known Fairfax and Prim Watsa for a long time. Clearly, we've been huge admirers of Berkshire Hathaway over the years, Brookfield and Bruce Flatt and his team over the years. And so there definitely is potential for XOR to become more like that, those categories of permanent capital vehicles able to invest OPM, whether it's float or third-party funds, and clip a coupon off that to generate leveraged equity-like returns, and you're a good capital allocator at the top. So to my earlier observation on conglomerates and platforms being magnifiers of capabilities, this would be a big magnifier of positive, you know, capability at XOR. But, you know, right now it's still seen as a European holdco. So it's in the same bucket as Investor AB or Industrial Varden or Eurasio, which always trade at 10, 20, 30% discounts to NAV. So, you know, XOR today is trading at a 30 to 40% discount to a conservative intrinsic value of what's underlying it. And that's not like an aggressive value. It's a, you know, pretty conservative underwriting. And that has no reflection for the potential to become something that should trade at a premium to NAV or a premium to book in the same parlance that, you know, a Berkshire or a Fairfax or something like that can trade at a premium to their book because of the capital compounding machine that's been built there. So I can see the potential for XOR to become that over the next decade or two. But right now, you don't even need that to happen. You just need to see the sum of the parts. But that certainly does not take away from the fact that we would have been really fortunate to have owned Fiat Chrysler at 3 and Ferrari at 25 and enjoyed those phenomenal runs. Shame on us.
Talk to us a little bit about how you approach this kind of an opportunity like an XOR, where, as you said, you like to go in at the top. When there's an asset like fiat that's such a major component of value, at least for now, how deep do you go into that asset, and what level of comfort do you require on that operating level, if you will, to then ultimately make the case for Exor?
Sorry. It's a great question. We go as deeply to the underlying as if we owned them directly. So we've spent, enormous amounts of time on Fiat Chrysler. We spent lots of time on Ferrari. Had the benefit of, being in Maranello last year, which is quite an experience. We actually have owned Case New Holland and do own Case New Holland directly in some capacities as well. So we treat them like we own the whole company. We own that one directly. So the PartnerRe, for example, we've invested in the reinsurance space for decades, and so have a pretty good network and understanding of who's doing what in that space. So when Exor acquired that at just a shade over book value, very opportunistically, we quickly were able to appreciate the value potential just in that company by itself, but then also in the broader potential to combine the whole into a Fairfax-like vehicle, if you will. But it's a lot of work when you get to these big multi-company kind of conglomerates to truly appreciate everything that's going on, in all the different parts of it. I think it is, worthwhile and time well spent. And as I said earlier, we would have been well served to take advantage of that and own some of those, the other two more directly as well. I would say, Fiat Chrysler is somewhat of a unique one in the auto world, in that there are still a lot of levers to pull. As we've seen the components sale, the rumors, and then the more solid announce recently on that, which was again at a premium to, what we would have assumed that business could be worth, which is, I've yet to see Exor announce a deal at a discount to what I thought it was going to be worth, put it that way. And so I'm happy to trust them on the allocation. It is important, though, as you look at the Exor level and kind of think about the look-through earnings, we do spend a lot of time about this. I mean, on a look-through level, it's kind of mid-nines or so of earnings power to the underlying assets. A half of that roughly is coming from Fiat Chrysler, and that might be some of what kind of the market discount on Exor is. If, half of your earnings are kind of auto-derived, I tend to look at that chunk of the earnings and say, Jeep and Ram in particular are two of the more attractive badges in the world as far as from an underdeveloped and underpenetrated portfolio, and that there's lots of room to push those units kind of independent of what the broader auto cycle does. And ultimately, those are pretty valuable assets for potentially somebody else at some point. I mean, I'm not banking on that. I'm not assuming that. But all you have to do is go back to Sergio Marchionne's presentation, Confessions of a Capital Junkie, to see that they very much appreciate that potential and that dynamic. And I don't think that's entirely gone away. I'd be remiss to not address Sergio and his untimely passing. I mean, he was their books will be written about him, in the pantheon of great executives of the last couple decades, for certain. And so, I mean, what he has accomplished and what he did and the role that he played at Exor can't be overstated, particularly at the time that he was involved. I think it was absolutely critical, the role he played. I don't think it's any disrespect to the amazing job he did and the amazing executive he was to say that we're not concerned from here about the potential of the firm and John's capabilities. And he had a phenomenal mentor, and he certainly thinks about capital allocation and business operation the right way. And there are a lot of good executives still, at Exor and at the sub companies.
Absolutely. Josh, if you don't mind, just a clarification. There's a question in the queue, and I don't know if Bloomberg has it right, but apparently on Bloomberg there's a note that Southeastern may have sold some Exor shares lately. Is that right? Can you comment at all?
Yeah, that's wrong. I don't know how to do this, but Bloomberg backs that as well. Most of these really misrepresent our non-US holdings. They tend to be pretty accurate on our US holdings, but miss the non-US holdings. So we have a while ago trimmed some Exor shares because it became like a by far the biggest position in the portfolio. But no, we've been buying recently. So we own today a little over 3% of the company.
Got it. Going a little bit more broadly again, looking at the business piece of your business people price framework, what does that imply for the sectors you like to look at? Do you have a preference for specific sectors? Is anything excluded? Specifically, I'm thinking of the shipping space that some say might be finally getting to sort of a recovery, and there are some owner operators in that space. So I'll just throw that to you.
Good. Yes, as you would expect, the areas we like are high margin, high return on capital, more, understandable and predictable businesses where we can have a degree of confidence about what it's going to look like 5 years from now, right? We are not good at forecasting fast changing or roiling industries or understanding, businesses where the revenue line is largely out of the firm's control or where the balance sheet is so opaque that we'll just never be able to understand it. And again, that's not saying that others, even others with strong value convictions can't invest in those spaces. We just think they're out of our circle of competence. So we tend to avoid, heavy commodity companies, companies where interest rates are going to determine your outcome disproportionately. We are not too shy about cyclical companies. Very successful investing over the decades in hotels and in cement and aggregates. Shipping is one, to your point, that we have talked about a lot, and I would not say fits in the can't invest category. Definitely some owner operators there. Definitely some interesting de-conglomeratization things happening in that space. So it's a very interesting one, and we don't have anything publicly disclosed, so forgive me if I can't go into too much detail, but it is an interesting place to be looking.
Okay, maybe switching to the people piece of the framework, I always like to add to the list of great owner operators. So, independent of the current opportunity or the price to value, who are some other owner operators in Europe that you particularly respect?
Oh, good question. Well, we've talked about Exor already, and I would just go down where other ones where we've been involved. We really respect Rafael Del Pino at Provial. He's had a good track record of thinking and acting like an owner in his business in Spain. So I would definitely put him on that list. Another one that's been interesting where we're not currently involved, but we have been over the years, is Stein Erik Hagen in Norway, who is chair of Orkla and has built a pretty amazing track record of value creation and realization. He's a very interesting one in Europe. And Vincent Bolloré has been a little bit more perhaps controversial, I guess, in the way that he's built his track record. But it's hard to argue with the numbers and the results that he has put up. And it's probably he is not done there. So I would certainly put him up in that camp. And then owner operators after that, there are a few just really great, operators that I've been really impressed by over the last few years. Warren East at Rolls-Royce has been pretty impressed with what he's done managing that organization. Has been very strong. So there's a handful.
That's helpful. Thank you. Maybe it would be interesting to know how you go about engaging with management, just from an outside perspective. Southeastern is not known as an aggressive activist and has not been in the headlines, but you do seem to engage and do so successfully. So please just share a little bit about your approach there.
Yeah. The way we like to think about it is we're always thinking and acting like owners. And so from 1975 on, we've treated the fractional ownership of public companies like we are owners of that company, and have a seat at the table to have conversations with the other important stakeholders, management and the board, and sometimes other shareholders. And so the definition of quote activism has kind of changed over the years, such that if you're making strategic suggestions or if you're making capital allocation suggestions, some call that activism. We just call that thinking and acting like an owner. So you're right. We are not trying to engage in aggressive public or adversarial activism. So everything that we invest in, we think and act like an owner. And then an appreciable number of the companies where we're involved, we'll have more direct conversations, more direct engagement. So on the board or on strategic outcomes or potential, like, have you thought about this? Or let's send a letter to the board just making views known on this potential opportunity, et cetera. And so that's maybe a third of the companies where we're involved. We have that, maybe even a little higher than that level of dialogue. But again, that's all positive dialogue. I remember one really interesting example where we went into a European company, and I'm not going to mention which one in this case, but with a deck and ideas on what they needed to do to help unlock some of the value and kind of get more efficient in their capital allocation and their conglomerate structure, and had a great conversation with the CEO and the CFO, who we'd known for a long time. It's not like we had just shown up saying, oh hey, you don't know who we are, but we think you should do this. And they listened, and good dialogue, and then went away and did something totally different than what we had suggested. But it was fine because we knew that philosophically they were thinking about it the right way. And of course, they're always going to have better information than we're ever going to be able to have about what's really internally happening at the firm. And so if we can, through our dialogue on capital allocation and big picture strategy, have confidence that management gets it, they're thinking and acting like an owner, then there's just way more confidence that their decision making is going to be correct. So the dialogue is as much about that litmus test as it is about getting them to do some specific thing, right? And once you find those great partners, you really do kind of want to get out of the way and let them operate, right? And if we are ever coming in making like specific suggestions around supply chain optimization or some actual specific technical business, they should just shut the office door and absolutely ignore us, because that's totally outside of our value add. But when it comes to capital allocation or some of the bigger picture stuff, then we do think there's something that we bring to the table. So I think to credibly have those conversations, you need to be seen and thought of as a long-term owner and not a renter of pieces of paper. And I like to think that we have that reputation in general, and in Europe specifically, such that when you sit down at the table, you're taken seriously. Some of that comes down to just track record of what you've done. Each country has different norms and expectations, whether it's legally or governance or just culturally on, the right way to approach that sort of conversation. And then the credibility that you bring will depend on, they're going to call around and be like, who are these people? And to have a track record of above board, constructive, effective, long-term operation is critical. So I just boil it down to say, having that owner-operator mentality, it helps that Southeastern is 100% private owned by employees. So we are owner-operators, and it's our own money. Southeastern and its affiliated parties is the largest investor in our AUM across all of our geographies. And so we truly are going in talking about, our own money as private owner operators, and that's much more effective as a dialogue.
You like to take significant stakes in the companies you invest in. How does that impact your portfolio composition? What is your view on concentration and the optimal level there?
Yeah. Well, the most concentrated we can kind of get with the vehicles that we do is kind of 12 to 20, and it's much more towards the high end of that. I'd say by wiring, a lot of us would probably be even lower than that, 10 to 12, as far as concentrating in your best ideas and getting enough. Just back to the old, Charlie Munger idea is like, what's irrational? You're actually acting irrationally if you find the sure bet and you only put 3% of your portfolio in it, right? And so our framework is the average portfolio is going to be, let's just put it in the 15 to 20 will be the average portfolio. But the largest five or six positions will be, over half of that. And those tend to be things that we've known for a long time, like Exor today. We've known it for a long time, and it's still very cheap. So it's one of the largest positions in our funds. It's not often that you own something for 6 years and it's compounded and done well, but still is one of the cheaper things out there. So we would be silly to size that as like a 2.5% position. So it's much more going to be like, a high single digits position. And if we build it up on a new position, we tend to scale a little bit. 2.5, 5, 6 type of thing on building the position. And, five for us is kind of a normal, if you will, an average, which seems pretty concentrated to most kind of institutional type investors, but seems pretty diverse to most private value people, if you will.
Josh, if it's okay with you, I'll take a couple more questions from the queue before we wrap it up. Want to acknowledge a comment here that's come in, essentially also a question, maybe you can comment on it, but the questioner says, for firms like Exor, should there not be a discount to the value of the holdings due to holdco costs and the loss of optionality of buy and selling the pieces? You're forced to hold cyclical businesses as a group versus holding parts as individual stocks. Any view on that?
Yeah, that's the traditional conglomerate view. What's the cost of the conglomerate? And that goes back to the observation that your cost of a conglomerate needs to outweigh the benefits of it need to outweigh, whatever the cost might be. So those are your costs. And it is very important to minimize the running costs of the conglomerate, which Exor does. Their corporate overhead is minuscule compared to the asset base. It's pretty impressive. But the loss of flexibility is a penalty if the people sitting at the top of that platform are not able to allocate that capital intelligently or across opportunities that you might not be able to access, from the outside. So what does that mean? Well, if there's the ability to integrate PartnerRe and use that to build a platform that, effectively is leveraging that float, or if, at Brookfield or at Fairfax, there is the ability to leverage other people's money, get a fee off of that in the Brookfield case, get the returns generated off of that in the insurance company space, and then allocate it across industrial opportunities or investment opportunities, that you're going to know better than anyone else, and maybe to create other competitive advantages, like Warren Buffett has done at Berkshire, where he is the home of choice for many, entrepreneurial companies looking for an exit, or founders looking for a home. And they might not be trying to get the highest price to get to the right home, if you will, right? So there's this great niche that's been created there. We can never, as kind of building a portfolio of Berkshire's holdings or the public companies that that Fairfax owns or that Exor owns, replicate that, right? So the questioner is right that in a subpar, if you will, conglomerate or holdco structure, there should be a discount for corporate costs and for inefficiencies. The nirvana is when you flip that the other way and you turn that holdco magnifier to a positive by accessing some of those opportunities that I just mentioned. I think that Exor is on the journey to moving towards that nirvana. But right now, even if you want to say, well, I'm going to put a 10% holdco discount on it until that's demonstrated, it's still very cheap, right? So either way, at this price, you're good to go.
And maybe one last question here. Again, painting with a very broad brush, talking about investing in the U.S. versus Europe, and whether you could reflect a bit on any differences, either in terms of the criteria you use, any checklist items that might be different, any corporate governance wrinkles. So just a very general question.
Yeah, going back to the spectrum that I outlined earlier, I think in the U.S., the capital markets and the culture of shareholder value has developed to the point that there is you can gain sufficient comfort with an agent operating your company to a greater degree than perhaps you can in markets where it's less developed, right? So in Europe, perhaps there's more emphasis on owner operators, more emphasis on having significant shareholders on the board, people who think and act like owners on the board or in the management team, whether they were the founders or not, but that they have appreciable net worth at play as far as the alignment of interests, because it's harder in our view to bank on an agent in some of those environments behaving in the predictable way that we're trying to get comfortable with, right? So I'd say the U.S., you can be a little bit more comfortable on that side of things. One of the interesting opportunities, U.S. versus Europe, is there are still companies in Europe that are pretty analogous with U.S. peers, but are either not appreciated or not understood, or a significant amount of their revenue comes from the U.S., but they're listed in the U.K. or in Europe, and there can be a lot of inefficiency and volatility that comes from that. And one that I think of that we're invested in recently was Hikma, which is domiciled in the U.K., but actually, reports in dollars, and the majority of its revenue and even bigger chunk of its value comes out of the sterile injectables business that's a predominantly U.S. business. And that's a great business, sterile injectables, high barrier to entry, very difficult for new entrants to get in. But Hikma also has a generics business, oral generics, like, traditional commodity oral generics in the U.S., which is just a straight commodity cyclical business. And they had done a poorly timed deal to get bigger in oral generics several years ago, right at the same time that Teva and Mylan and others were doing their big debt fuel deals. At least in the case of Hikma, it wasn't with debt. They issued overpriced shares in overpriced pounds, along with a little bit of balance sheet cash to get the deal done. So it was less impactful and didn't leverage up the company to the downside, but still the share price got hammered because it was treated like a U.S. oral generics business. And there was a little bit of Brexit overhang, in our opinion, because it was UK listed. There was a lot of currency mismatch because it traded in pounds but most of the value and most of the revenue are generated in dollars. So that leads to a lag and a lot of noise in the financials. And, you know, noise in the financials and inefficiency in the story, your friction, if you will, in the story is great for value investors who are willing to do the work, because that's a lot harder to for a short term an algorithm or somebody with a 3 month outlook to take advantage of. So we were big investors in Hikma over the course of kind of late 17, early to 18. And there were big owner operators there. The Darwaza family, who had founded it, the father had founded it several decades ago. The next generation was running it. Saeed Darwaza was chairman and CEO. And we knew they were aligned, and we knew they were thinking the right way. And this is another good example of how we have what we like to think of as an owner-oriented dialogue. So we would sit down with Mr. Darwaza and other people at the firm and say, well, what about this? Have you thought about this? Shouldn't you be buying back stock at this price? You know, what about these things? And all the while, they were having, you know, even bigger picture discussions, because Saeed was making the decision that he wasn't the right person to be the CEO of the firm for the future. He would remain as executive chairman, but he brought in really well-respected Siggy Olafsson as an executive to run the actual pharma operations. And to me, that was like the excellent, great indicator of owner-operator mentality. He fired himself from the CEO role and went and hired an outsider, first outsider, you know, in the history of the family company, to come in and you know, optimize the business. So they didn't do any of the suggestions that we were putting on, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? But it was a litmus test for that owner-operator mentality, which the family passed with like flying colors, AAA+. But we, you know, sadly, the share price appreciated so quickly that it went through our estimate of intrinsic value, and our discipline internally is that when a share price goes through intrinsic value, we're selling. And that was really disappointing in this case, because I think there's a lot of opportunity and that Hikma is very well managed and has a long runway. But, you know, we're not going to own something at 110% of what it's worth. Now it's come off a little bit since we sold it. And so I don't think it's quite to that same level anymore. But that's a great example of some of the inefficiency that you can get around some of these, you know, European different currency frictions.
And just for the benefit of everyone listening, this is Hikma Pharmaceuticals, London listed ticker HIK.
Correct. And still one to watch.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for leaving us with that idea to add to our list.
Yeah,
Josh.
I probably should have put the Darwaza family in that European executives to keep an eye on list after the last year.
Terrific. Good. Well, Josh, thank you so much. I know it's a busy time for you, so we truly appreciate you taking the time to be here with our members today. Share your insights and ideas. It's always a pleasure to learn from you.
Well, it's a pleasure to learn from you and the community and all the great interviews that you do and the information that you compile. It's been, I think I've been honored to be around it for a good while now, and really appreciate the work that's done, and thanks to everybody who's involved and contributes.
Well, thank you as well, and we look forward to future opportunities.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.